Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
Let's see. Ivy, did you have a question for Dr. Curry? Line should be open.
Yes, sir. Greetings, Gus. Greetings, Dr. Curry, and to all the callers on the line. Dr. Curry, I wanted to know, how much do you think that the strength dynamic between men and women and males and females played into the perception of Adrian Peterson when he dealt with his child and the woman who dealt with hers?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. But that's also because of the kind of hyper physicality that we impose on black men, right? You'll notice that most of the demonizations that we get of black men always include some kind of physical violence. Very rarely do we talk about black men as imposing psychological harm on people. It's always physicality and brute force. And you notice it's very different than how we talk about white female victims or even, you know, who it was the Baldwin who people were saying was psychologically abusing his daughter because he left her a foul-mouthed message on her answering machine, right? We speak about black males differently. So I think you're absolutely right. I think that part of it was the strength difference, but I think that it's also part of how we view black men using their bodies and using their physical power. Because we think black men are faster, stronger, quicker, superhuman, athlete, et cetera, anytime we see those kinds of men hit a woman or discipline a child, we're going to, of course, say that this fails in kind of the most egregious forms of violence that we could ever imagine. You know, but again, we know that white NFL players, many of whom, you know, suffer from CTE like black male players, are just as violent, if not more violent, but they're never depicted that way by society.
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Thursday, January 3, 2019. So I have been told, New Year, same terrorism. I think right now in Houston, Dr. Curry is in Texas. In Houston, they're talking about a black 7-year-old girl shot and killed. Suspected race soldiers just driving by, saw niggers in a vehicle, opened fire. Hasn't been caught, arrested, charged. That's just a report from the New Year, same white terrorism. This is the Cal's Book Club. The Man Not Race, Class, Genre, and the Dilemmas of Black Manhood, Dr. Tommy J. Curry. We have one more session after this week, and we'll be all done. We're picking up this week. We're right at the end of Chapter 5, like last couple pages, and then we're going to the conclusion. We will finish it up next Thursday. I can only say really quick, I was at yoga this week, of course. Taking my January 1 New Year's classes, plural. I'm at the first one, non-white female cowbell. She does have a white parent. And double whammy, tragic arrangement, her fiance, white male. She comes up to me. She says, "Hey, guess what I did for New Year's Eve?" I said, "What did you do?" She said, "I went to a concert. I went to see Talib Kweli, she pronounced the name correctly. I say, oh, wow, he was here in Seattle? Yes, he was. In fact, he lives here. I didn't know that, but we'll see. She says, he was here. It was so great. My white fiance, he's a huge fan. He loves Talib Kweli and Mos Def and all those guys. And it was just great. I learned so much. I couldn't wait to run back and tell you, impress the niggers. Now, when she tells me this, the first thing I think of is, I think a listener mentioned it, Talib Kweli just had a tiff with Dr. Curry on social media. Now, I didn't know about this until the listener mentioned it. During the book club, I searched online. You can see this in the timeline. There was a point in 2018, this was recent, Talib Kweli made a post where he was saying he was encouraging whites to acknowledge their white privilege, VGQ, and he compared it. He made a metaphor between quote unquote white privilege and saying that males, all males, have male privilege. Dr. Curry, the scholar, immediately stepped in and asked Mr. Kweli, can you provide examples for how black males exercise male privilege? Excellent question. You can check online to see all of this. But that is what I thought when I heard Talib Kweli, him and the exchange with Dr. Curry, victim of racism, VGQ. He has his opinion. But again, that is why we are reading this here text. The confusion about the alleged power, domination, abilities of the black male in the system of racism, white supremacy. Without further ado, we shall begin. The Man Not, Dr. Tommy J. Curry, Context of White Supremacy. This is audio segment number one. The presenting of the biological sign for male totalizes our understanding and discourse. He is male and thereby like Western man because such categorization functions specifically within our grammar and the symbolic order that sustains such relations as our reality. This is how meaning is established and resonates in the world. Such is the case with the categories imposed on our study of black maleness. They are culturally, politically, and institutionally legitimated first. Gender is imposed on the black male as part of a predetermined set of structures and cultural assumptions about maleness. This narrative of domination asserts the black male to be a burgeoning patriarch despite his historical inability to be the white type of male capable of political, economic, and structural domination, and despite his vulnerability to anti-black death. This repetitive reality, which has continued throughout the centuries, has had no substantive effect on the manner by which black maleness is spoken about within disciplines. To motivate the consideration and inclusion of femininity, masculinity is thought to be all-powerful and, as such, written about in complete hierarchical opposition to femininity. While not historically captured by this generalization, black masculinity is spoken about within a totalizing schema asserting that, although black men have been particularly erased from and neglected by history and denied political power and recognition, the partial historical survey of black men available affirms black masculinity as the dominating ethos of the black male. Because the black male is thought of as a problem subject, no reflective redemption can be spoken of within this gendered schema. He is always already a potential brute capable of exactly the murder and violence anti-blackness asserts is part of his character. These barbaric caricatures of black maleness are historically salient in the minds of scholars and policymakers precisely because they are thought of as the same figures throughout the centuries, the rapists and killers of women. While dismissed in name as racist, the sanctions used to police and terrorize black maleness are thought to be absolutely necessary given the gender predilection black men are asserted to have toward women. Contrary to the intersectional dividing up of the subject, the gender category involving black maleness is part of the black man's entrapment within the anti-black matrix of his existence. It cannot be extricated from the systems of power that give shape to the language used to speak of and describe gender as if it exists in a neutral and pure form. Thus, the observer, the intellectual, is determined, recognized, rewarded in large part by this activity of description itself. Bauman reminds us that the line dividing intellectuals and non-intellectuals is drawn and redrawn by decisions to join in a particular mode of activity. So the Grammar Act, the signifying system deployed as Winter suggests, must remain conceptualized as culturally reifying and compatible with the actual institutions representing the structures that house the tools of study. The black academic bourgeois learn to use these categories to save themselves from death, categories that allow us to cling to life, recognition, solidarity with the worker or the woman or the progressive that breathe life into the thingified sociogenic product of anti-black racism that is anthropologically participating in and by consequence beyond or seen as more than the inanimate properties of the black thing. In No Humans Involved, Winter concretizes what this relationship between discursive legitimacy and power means for the unhumanized in what she calls the historical racial schema that predefines his body as an impurity to be cured, a lack, a defect, to be amended into the true being of whiteness. Our conceptual schema as being American is, in fact, a distancing from the jobless black man who is targeted for death. Winter's analysis reiterates the economic analysis of Brown and the larger ontological point made by Newton in Fear and Doubt. It is this category of the jobless young black males who have been made to pay the sacrificial cost, in the terminology of René Girard's The Scapegoat, 1986, for the relatively improved conditions since the 1960s that have impelled many black Americans out of the ghettos and into the suburbs, that made possible, therefore, the universal acclamation for the Cosby-Huxtable TV family, who proved that some black Americans could aspire to and even be drawn inside the sanctified category of Americanness in its present form. This ascendancy of specific classes of black Americans, those black Americans who aspire to be seen as different from those not humans or those niggers, have been achieved through neglecting the death of black men and boys and embracing negrophobia. The manifestation of negrophobic sentiment in the writing and scholarship of black intellectuals is institutionally rewarded and marks the difference between the plain black folk and the black intellectual, specifically with regard to how black intellectuals use intersectional categories to distance themselves and caricature those other blacks. A problem emerges in how we assign, describe, and evaluate the conditions of black people. The black male is constrained into categories that are suitable for expressing academic analysis, but inadequate for expressing his actual being, academic categories that continue to ignore the limitations and moralities that are privileged in the study of him in these sorts of conditions. In short, our blindness, our indifference to black male death, our seeking recognition of life through our descriptions of him as barbarous only fuels the necromantic rage of white supremacism, the sexual racism, the desire for the black body, and the intellectual obsession with speaking of him as corpse. Our attention to the empirical reality of black men and boys suffering sexual racism proves that sexual violence is not married to the narrowing category of gender, which is summarily denied to this group. The task is not to fold the black male into the gender category as an attempt to resuscitate his being. To study the black male is not to write him into recognition, but rather to reject such an urge. The black male is not simply an unrecognized identity. He is an existence that resists, reformulates, recasts, and endures, though currently unknown as such throughout time. As such, his being must be accounted for with new theory that goes beyond the simple classifications of gender and race that presume caricature. He must be the subject of genre studies. Similarly, for Winter, the black male is not only the NHI, but also Baldwin's captive population, Frantz Fanon's Les Dames, constrained, castrated within the existing taxonomies, categories built on the assumptions of a white Western man. His inclinations are limited by how we describe and, by effect, know and mean the black male. Drawing on Asmaron, Legacy's Gata, Three Approaches to the Study of African Society, Winter argues that the black male is, in fact, condemned by the sociogenic principle of his negation, the man not. Black manhood is created as the inadequate, the degraded and fleeting, the ever-dying body. Legacy argues that this rule-governed negation of the subject or group of subjects is the province of the liminal, not because these subjects lack recognition by the structure, but because the structure depends on their marginality, or in the case of the black male, his death, to legitimize itself. Legacy emphasizes this point, stating, the liminal person is not irrelevant to the structured community surrounding him. On the contrary, he is its conceptual antithesis and therefore very relevant to its continued existence. It is by reference to him that the structured community defines and understands itself. The liminal, then, is a condition of study, a foundation from which new grammars and cultural systems can be formulated. This is why Winter concludes No Humans Involved with a reminder to the reader that the starving fella, or the jobless inner city NHI, the global new poor, or the damned, Fanon pointed out, does not have to inquire into the truth. They are the truth. It is we who institute this truth. We must now undo their narratively condemned status. Winter's recognition of the black male as the truth cultivates the liminal being as a genre study of death and dying, a study of the creative potential of the particular type of being not allowed, a kind of sociogenic inadequacy created as the farthest distance from the white Western human form. It is from our exploration of the cosmologies and political incongruence of black maleness, its notness, that we better understand the categorical architecture of subjectivity and the faults that justify the logics from which black male relation in the world is thought. Legacy suggests that it is from this exploration of contradiction, rooted not simply in experience, but also in the consequence of liminal existence, that the liminal person reminds us that we need not forever remain prisoners of our prescriptions. He generates conscious change by exposing all the injustices inherent in structure, by creating a real contradiction between structure and anti-structure, social order, and man-made anarchy, in sharp contrast to the contemporary configurations of race and gender, which seek to dismiss the idea of the black male as a necessitating thought. Winter's work suggests that his study, rather than his apotheosis, as subject par excellence, is necessary to dissolve the mythologies that dictate our encounters with the material world and his actual death. The black man exists as a kind of human being, a new human possible, who creates, negates, and reflectively interprets the world around him. He creates art and experiences tragedy. He is resistant just as he is frail. He is the possible that emerges from the inadequate ethno-class of Western man, what we now mistake as the human. Conclusion. In thinking about blackness, the black scholar removes black existence from the horrors of America, preferring to think of blackness as unrealized possibility. This is a conceptual failing of black scholarship that Frank Wilderson describes as people consciously or unconsciously peeling away from the strength and the terror of their evidence in order to oppose some kind of coherent, hopeful solution to things. It is in this act, the cessation of inquiry, whereby the epistemic is collapsed into the political, ontological, that the dereliction of black thought, its predilection toward becoming a racial normative, is apparent. Much like the dilemmas found in dealing with black death and confronting the genocidal tendencies that haunt the lives of black men articulated in Winter's No Humans Involved, there is a need to sanitize, make tolerable, academify black male existence so that it becomes not nihilistic and fatalist, but alive thought experiment that is revised around improvement and optimism, a discursive design that offers the white listener, reader, or colleague entrance into the possibility of being an anti-racist, compassionate white reformist invited by the graciousness of the black theorist. The black scholar is rewarded for such hypothetical ventures that cosign the disdain whites have for black men as violent, antisocial, dysfunctional, and so on. Black males are the depositories of the negativity traditionally associated with blackness that makes transcendence socially, politically, and conceptually possible for other black bodies. Hating them solidifies the class position and indicates the class aspirations of other blacks. There is an eerie connection between the deaths of black males in society and the erasure of black male life in the realm of theory. In reality, black males are genred as non-human and animalistic in the minds of whites, but our theories relish assigning the death of black males to the generic description of racism, a notion not thoroughly analyzed in identity scholarship and unable to adequately capture the specific kind of oppression and violence that defines black male existence. Because this racist societal architecture is de-emphasized, academic discourses of race, class, gender, presupposing the infinite power of all male bodies, prefigures a conceptual calculus dedicated to eradicating the vulnerability of black men because they are men. The black male is thought to be a mimetic white patriarch, an untenable theoretical position given the empirical evidence of black male disadvantage that serves only to affirm the disposition that his death is the only way to remedy the dangers he poses to society. Not man, but not some nothing. Affirming who I cannot be through a genre study of black male death and dying. I thought I knew him. When I met myself, I saw him, but as I was educated, I was taught not to see, but imagine, and through imagining fear, what I thought I knew, but could no longer recognize. Theory did this. I taught me who I, he, it could not be, and was for its sake not his. What does it mean to think of the black male, to pull the meaning of his existence away from his body to be used by thought? How possible is it for him to be thought of, studied, or engaged beyond the historical characterizations that relegate him to the macho, the criminal, the liar, the rapist, the murderer, the thug, the deadbeat father, the abuser, the misogynist, the beast cub, the super predator, or the devil? Is he nothing more than an unactualized human, a fatally flawed thing struggling not against the murderous logics that rationalize his death, but against the savageness assigned to him that continues to justify treating him as a non-human entity? The black male is unthought. He is an intuitive problem, an analytic failing designated by the negative ascriptions of blackness and maleness. He is a being who is described and defined by his menace, with little need to be understood as a living and complex human being subject to external and environmental forces and vulnerable to the mental anguish or depression of his death, imprisonment, and abuse within the present order of American society. Because he is the nigger, possessing only the nature of a savage thing, driven almost solely by his animal intuitions and lust for violence, he is said to have no sociological, historical, or economic causes for his behavior. He is only an unyielding victim of his nature. This account of black manhood is a caricature. It does not represent black men and boys as reflective and impressionable human beings. It offers thinkers a display of a black entity that demands no recognition or consideration beyond the fear he inspires or the problems he presents to society. Despite the language of intersectionality and anti-essentialism and the emphasis on progressivism and pluralization, this caricature is the foundation of various disciplinary theories concerning black males. Many of the tropes surrounding black masculinity rely for effect on a savage heterosexualism. For example, the long-standing myth of the black rapist depends entirely on an insatiable and violent lust by black men for women. While such mythology is usually cast as a historical relic in our contemporary conversations about black masculinity, there are very real murders of black men by police and white vigilantes that justify a closer look at the specific motivations behind black male death. The execution of Jonathan Farrell by police for seeking help from a white woman named Sarah McCartney immediately comes to mind. McCartney's 911 call and tears urging the police to help her conveyed a very real cultural cue that required lethal force to put down the black male beast who, McCartney claims, was trying to kick down her door. However, despite such vulnerability, which rears itself even in the logic of mass shootings such as that by Dylann Roof, in which a white supremacist shooter announced, You rape our women, and you're taking over our country, and you have to go. Black maleness is continually denied consideration as sexually vulnerable and a stigma operating to justify the murder of all blacks. Despite its societal impact, black maleness is theorized as black masculinity and thereby relegated to an isolated function. It is distanced from its empirical consequence in such a way that it can be justifiably rendered insignificant as a field of study in the academy, especially when dealing with the experiences and impositions imposed on the heterosexual black male body. In many ways, the theoretical articulations of masculinity, specifically our understandings of black masculinity, are offered only as the cause of every historical ill, such that femininity, since it is thought to be the opposite of masculinity, becomes the almost intuitive solution. Such oppositional appeals to the feminine are just as illusory as the disowning of the masculine. Just as white masculinity and femininity were symbiotic relations that reified similar values, political goals, and aspirations specifically on matters of race, so too did black masculinity and femininity overlap historically, endorsing the same values, political goals, and aspirations. This is not to say that there are no differences within these groups based on economic position, religion, and the like, but to acknowledge explicitly that the assumed differences in the values and politics between genders currently attributed to being a man versus being a woman have little historical evidence. As shown throughout Chapter 1, many of the ideas that are used to condemn 19th century black males as sexist and decadent, such as their emphasis on black women focusing on the home and being good mothers, not only were explicitly endorsed by 19th century black women as well, but also were the basis of educated bourgeois black women's altruism toward the lower classes. Yet such nuance, while apparent in history, is lacking in our theoretical accounts of black men throughout the centuries. Nuance, the attention to detail and contextual distinction, is absent from many theoretical accounts of black gender relations because history is replaced by symbols that come to represent fixed ontological dispositions. The historical character of black men exhibited throughout the centuries is elided by popular mythologies that hold heterosexual black males to be rapists, machos, bucks, or criminals. The actual vulnerabilities and thinking of black men from the mid-1900s are ignored altogether for narratives linking late 19th century black intellectuals to mid-20th century black civil rights activists. Black male patriarchy is thought to be evidenced by the nationalism of race men of the late 1800s and evolves from their 19th century ethnological thinking to the black power movement of the 1970s. Jim Crowism and the specific violence, both physical and sexual, endured by black men and boys for the better part of a century are completely ignored in favor of an abridged account of black masculinity that is defined by the interest specific classes have in propagating the myth of black men as savages. Under this historiography, black nationalism was not a reaction black men had as humans to their unbridled murder at the hands of whites, their rape by white men or women, or their economic oppression. It was only their pursuit of power so that they could take their place alongside white males. They are thought only to be violent, the largest killers of themselves, and abusive to all those around them. Black males are not thought of as sociological beings that have existential relevance for theory. Because theory is the abstraction from the empirical, the attempt to establish the idea as casually related to actual phenomena, there is the risk that theory will remain disconnected from the world and from the relations the selves in that world share. Sometimes the idea becomes self-justifying and thought of as determining the phenomena from which it was initially derived. This is the problem with black masculinity. It is an idea that obscures how black males actually live and die in the world. In other words, theory never posits that black men behave violently or criminally because they are victims of poverty, prior physical or sexual abuse, or mental anguish caused by racism and their specific sexual vulnerability to both men and women. Gender theorists are never asked to imagine the conditions that determine choice or their lack thereof. Regardless of the social phenomenon one attends, theory asserts that black men's higher rates of homicide, domestic abuse, and crime, and even their political attitudes, are the consequence of their obsession over their lack of power and patriarchy. This answer, which relies on essentialist and biological notions of maleness thought to have been rejected decades ago, remains unchallenged in its contemporary iterations. In our present moment, these essentialist identity accounts of social phenomena remain safe behind theoretical labels thought to disown the dangers of such categorical mistakes. Stated differently, because post-structuralism and intersectionality are thought to be and are popularized as anti-essentialist paradigms, there has been a reluctance to identify essentialist notions that are still operating within these theories. Across disciplines, black males' behavior, politics, and aspirations are explained by their cultural appropriations of white violence and their desire for white masculinity. Their violence is rooted in a theoretically justified circularity. Black men are violent because black men are violent, a premise that is rarely questioned and often is taken as truth. The reality is that any question that approaches a serious inquiry into black male vulnerability is more than a scholarly exercise seeking to present evidence to the contrary of the stereotypes of the black male in society and the dogmas that guide the interpretation of his existence throughout the centuries. To study the black male as historically vulnerable for being black and male due to his criminalization and the denial of his victimization, sexually and economically, is to assert a position that contravenes the assumed meaning of gender itself. Studying black men and boys as constituted by a historically relevant but academically denied sexual vulnerability unsettles the disciplinary boundaries of gender that are being used as intuitive indicators of the female and undermines the reasons used to justify the present academic order of public intellectuals and pundits. These theories diminish the actual vulnerabilities of black males by overdetermining black male life via the stereotypes of the black male's aspiration to dominate and his alleged danger to others. By holding that black males are dangerous, lusting after the power to dominate others, gender theory and popular intellectual works actually deny the intrinsic value of black male life and assert that all social problems endured by or involving black men, whether their deaths at the hands of white police or vigilantes or the violence in their communities or homes, actually emanate from their nature. This violent black masculinity is thought to be irredeemable through its own faculties. In other words, black masculinity is permanently stained, a defect akin to original sin. Contemporary gender theorists maintain that the only hope for black men and boys lies in reformulating black masculinity toward a black feminist ethics, although this claim is largely accepted by the culture of disciplines throughout the university, it has never been substantiated with any actual proof. Instead, it is insisted on as if the only proper moral conclusion given the direction of gender theory in the university. Why is it necessary to understand black masculinity as problematic, redeemable only by the externalized politics of other groups, rather than through the study of black males' actual lives and realities? What makes black manhood such a problem that it cannot be studied but only condemned and reconstructed from the position of moral condemnation? Violence does not stain femininity regardless of its prevalence or cruelty, but individual black men constitute evidence of an all-encompassing personality that determines the ends of black males from birth. Denied individuation, black men and boys are all thought to be manifest this curse. Beyond Caricature, an assessment of black masculinity in the lives of black men and boys under our present order. James Baldwin once remarked, "I am not a nigger. I's a man, but if you think I am a nigger, it means you need it. Why? That's the question you have got to ask yourself. Does the university, its disciplines, its gender theory, truly believe the black male is a nigger, a violent super predator lacking morality, compassion, or reason?" Baldwin's question forces scholars of black manhood and boyhood to demand an answer from theory itself, an answer for what appears to be a symbiotic bond between the racist ideology of American society and theories of gender in the academy. Why does academic theory need the nigger to hold itself, its histories, together? Would patriarchy be less of a historical phenomenon if it did not include the journey of the black male from slavery to citizen? Does gender theory need a black male caricature thought to be apathetic about, if not fundamentally opposed to, black women's issues, anti-women? What is it about theory that it depends on a black male that is violent, dangerous, and immoral to motivate its analysis of patriarchy? Such questions emerge not because they are at all natural to the existence of the black male in America, but as a response to the interpretive paradigms elevated to fact about his existence within theories that concern him. The black male is ultimately the depository of all social ills. He is thought to be the origin of all of the domestic abuse, violence, homicide, homophobia, and rape in the black community. As scholars, we might ask why all of the sociological, economic, psychological, and medical traumas that we know as linked to these maladies disappear simply from conceptualizing black men? And more important, what sort of evidence or principle of discernment allows all of these sociological phenomena to be posited as facts and analysis in journals, conferences, and blogs as fundamentally tied to the black male's ontology and sexual biology? Black masculinity has become the name of these analytic truths in many regards to say a racial account is masculinist, or that a phenomenon originates from black masculinity is to suggest that the maleness operating in the construction is condemnable. This ontology of black masculinity is deathly allergic to empiricism. Thus, it avoids historical, psychological, and sociological accounts of Black male life in America, often sustaining its force through the adamants by which it is asserted the conviction that Black masculinity is the evil birthed by the Black male's attempt to grasp his rights in America and gain political power has become the plot undergirding his journey toward freedom. As an interpretive lens, this account allows Black males to be dismissed as potential leaders, political actors, or thinkers, since all thoughts and ends they produce share the same defects. This essentialism holds that Black masculinity is predestined to crave domination and power over others despite its actual societal vulnerabilities. Concerning Black masculinity, our current order simply asserts teleology to be the defining aspect of ontology. The presumed purpose or end of Black males, what we think of when we speak of Black masculinity, is domination and the subjugation of women, so it is assumed that all acts of Black males aim toward this end. This perspective has now become accepted as the product of theoretical innovation and continues to overshadow evidence of the actual values expressed by Black males throughout the centuries. In this case, Ockman's law of parsimony reduces Black males to the racist platitudes of our day while demanding that the most obvious social problems Black men exhibit be considered a manifestation of something more ontological. The inability of scholars to make distinctions between the theoretical attributes associated with Black masculinity, its end and very being, and the actual existence, lives, and death of Black men and boys is evidence of how stereotypes is allowed to become theory. It is far too common for contemporary feminist analysis of Black masculinity to simply retreat into racial stereotypes that apply the logics of power and domination to the fundamental character of every Black male in society. Black males such as Ray Rice, convicted of domestic abuse, or Adrian Peterson, punished for disciplining his child, are simply examples of how the masculine desire to dominate women and children is imposed without context or empirical substantiation. Rice's domestic assault was depicted as the fulfillment of a male birthright thought to unite all men in America despite racism and their economic distance at the expense of women and every other group. Michelangelo Cingoreal holds that Ray Rice's assault of Jhené Rice convincingly proves there is no real need for particular distinctions in masculinity, since masculine identity, as defined for generations, is so culturally powerful that it cuts across class and race boundaries, bonding men of all kinds together. Similarly, Peterson's whipping of his child, whether one agrees with corporal punishment or not, is depicted as an exclusively male phenomenon used by Peterson to teach his son a lesson in patriarchy that a man's power comes from the control and degradation of weaker others. Despite the prevalence of whipping throughout lower socioeconomic communities generally, and within Black communities specifically, it is only when Black men whip children that the act becomes patriarchal and dominating. For context, when Peterson whipped his son with a switch for pushing his brother, he was charged with felony child abuse. But when Toya Graham was recorded on video assaulting her 16-year-old son, cursing at him, hitting him in the head and face, and pushing him, she was called a hero and mom of the year. Contrary to the focus on Black males' use of corporal punishment, multiple studies confirm that black women of lower and middle socioeconomic status believe in the use of corporal punishment on children as a normal form of discipline. In fact, qualitative studies have shown that black mothers view the ability to physically discipline a child as their mother right, while children's grandmothers, aunts, uncles, and biological fathers had to earn the privilege of disciplining through prior acts that earned mothers trust that the individuals really cared about their children. Here again, despite actual fact or accountability to the complexity of corporal punishment in working class communities, the black male is used as a scapegoat to link the use of spanking to abuse and parental negligence to the racist trope of black patriarchal violence and domination, a theory that simply does not hold for black parents and their rearing of their children. As discussed in Chapter 3, none of these theories of masculinity take into account the sociological, cultural, and economic conditions that facilitated the violence between Ray and Janae Rice. There is no thought about the factors that contribute to the escalation of domestic violence, such as alcohol use or bidirectionality of violence, as was displayed between the Rices. Ray Rice is a black man. Janae Rice is a black woman. Therefore, he aims to dominate her. Such simplistic renderings, which simply apply predetermined categories to individuals, have become the pillar of gender analysis when dealing with black males. The economic, cultural, and psychological motivations that condition such responses are disregarded in favor of an overarching narrative of the black male as a violent patriarch, a cog in a conceptual scheme that reduces black male life to the examples or proof of a predetermined abstraction. Far too often, this fatalism concerning black men and boys is defended as theory. Despite the disavowal by the creator of the Duluth model, which insists that men abuse women because they are men who seek power over others, the ideological function of the position is so solidified culturally that its application, even erroneously, is thought of as proper gender analysis. Context of white supremacy. End of the first audio segment, Dr. Tommy J. Curry, The Man Not Race, Class, Genre, and the Dilemmas of Black Manhood. We are almost done. By the time we finish the audio segment this week, we'll have the epilogue. We'll have a little bit more of the conclusion and the epilogue. So we should be done early. Next week. That would be my guess. We will definitely finish next week and shouldn't even take the entire 3 hours. Whoopee. If you have questions, thoughts you would like to share, the number 641-715-3640, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Number again, 641-715-3640, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. I forgot to include the update at the beginning. Despite technical interference, I was able to upload a substantial amount of content to the iTunes feed today. It worked, so I just sat and uploaded for, you know, about 2 hours. But it's not totally current, but it is pretty close. I think it had not updated in about 3 months or so. But I think all of the content from September, October, maybe even November is in the iTunes feed now. I just need to get December and we'll get to work on January 2019. But iTunes feed updated, and I was not able to log in at Black Talk Radio Network last week, but got that corrected. Not sure what the issue was there, but able to log in, and I think it is current. I wasn't able to log in for about a week, but it is current, up to date. Everything was uploaded from the time I wasn't able to log into the site. So apologies to anyone who had their, I guess, following along with the book club or any of the other archives from being able to access the content, but it is there. It was at SoundCloud all along. The content is in multiple places, but iTunes, and that means all of the other aggregate sites that are connected to iTunes within the next 24 hours or so, they should also be updating since there'll be new content from the archives there. So you should be able to refresh, reload if that makes it easier to access or share Cal's content. Again, whoopee. We will get to question again since it came up. Thanks to Ivy. Her question to Dr. Curry, that was from September of this year. I got that. It's now in iTunes. That's one that was not in the iTunes. It is now. Dr. Curry's visit from just a couple of months back. We talked about the U.S. Open, Serena Williams, and all of that, and this book. She asked the question about the difference in parenting. I would be interested to know, we talk about metaphors all the time. You heard the comparison in the book. Interestingly, Dr. Curry didn't include Supermom Toya Graham was assaulting her 16-year-old son who was out being a rioter and a looter in the streets of Baltimore, Maryland, following the death of Freddie Gray in police custody. That was not included for important context. So is that a reasonable comparison? Toya Graham beating her 16-year-old Adrian Peterson, beating his 6-year-old for pushing his brother. Reasonable comparison or no? Curious thoughts. And again, thoughts about discipline. Wow, I thought that was so huge. In fact, I'll give you the footnote. As I said last week, he has lots of footnotes in the text, which I appreciate. I think it's spectacular. Lots of opportunities to research. But he included footnotes for that section on Toya Graham, Adrian Peterson, and Black parents' thoughts on spanking and or disciplining, corporal punishment, as they say. So this is from footnote number 8 from the conclusion of the text. This is about corporal punishment. Ellen Pender Hughes, Kenneth A. Dodge, John E. Bates, Gregory S. Pettit, and Arnaldo Zelli, Discipline Responses, Influence of Parents' Socioeconomic Status, Ethnicity, Beliefs About Parenting, Stress, and Cognitive Emotional Processes, Journal of Family Psychology. And then the next one is Mary Strauss and Julie H. Stewart, Corporal Punishment by American Parents, National Data on Prevalence, Chronicity, Severity, and Duration in Relation to Child and Family Characteristics. And then footnote 9 is talking about corporal punishment. 9 low-income African-American mothers talk punishment. It's from Early Childhood Research Quarterly. When I heard all of this, I was reminded of the report that we played on the compensatory call-in, I think, last month. I think it was early December, where whites recently strengthened their guidelines against any form of corporal punishment for any reason. And they included verbal abuse in the guidelines. And they said that what I remember specifically, or what one aspect of the report that really stood out, was that they said corporal punishment causes brain damage. It disrupts the developing brain's ability to form and grow in a healthy manner. That was one of the main things that stood out from the report, corporal punishment. Anywho, folks who dialed in, number 641-715-3640, the code 564-943-pound. *61 if you have comments to share. Let's see. Thomas in New York, do you have commentary? You should be with us, sir. Might not be.
Good evening, Gus.
Greetings, sir.
Greetings. Greetings to all the callers. I don't know. I might be suffering from negrophobia, Gus. I don't know. Another week, very good commentary from the doctor, very eloquently describing the problem. I wouldn't compare those two cases. One being that it was a 10-year difference between a 16-year-old is pretty much an adult in some states, and a 6-year-old is a child. However, corporal punishment, I try not to, but sometimes, your children do things that they need to get, knocked upside the head for. It's for their own good, I wouldn't compare. I would say that in most instances, when a male is to discipline in a child, it gets a little worse than when a female does it, I think, because, you're a man, you have certain strengths and, certain levels of tolerance that you won't, do. So I tend to let my wife do that unless it gets out of hand, then I'll get involved. But, I think that it serves the same way with white men. However, the way the system is set up, anything we do, it gets magnified. So, it's already coming from a negative context. I believe that if white people say that corporal punishment leads to brain damage, they're probably right, because enacted corporal punishment on our ancestors during shadow slavery, and we still haven't bounced back from that. We still suffering from the traumatic stress from that event. So, very interesting reading, but for sure, Adrian Peterson's situation compared to the lady who beat her 16-year-old. I believe that was during the riots in Baltimore, I think. But either way, totally not the same. And also, as much as I empathize with the position they put Ray Rice in, I saw the man punch a woman and drag her off an elevator. So, in at the same sense, he did what he did. I mean, some punishment was enacted. I still haven't seen a white football player punch a woman and drag her off the elevator, so I would love to see what happens if that goes down. But Roethlisberger, with all his rapes, he's still in the league, so, you can add that in. But I'll beat my line, guys. Thank you.
For sure. I think just with the Ray Rice situation, I don't think Dr. Curry was saying that he should not have been punished, or that there was, was any way trying to suggest that what he did was not deplorable. It was, but I think the point he was making was that incident was used to make a statement about all black males in general, and males in general. I think that was the point that he was saying, that it wasn't. It's the main point of the section, that it was not a deplorable act by an individual. This is representative of black males and males on the whole. That was the point that he used with Ray Rice. Let's see. Other folks who dialed in, if you have a hand up, line should be open. Proceed.
Can I be heard?
Greetings, retired firefighter.
Greetings, Gus. Greetings, everyone. I'll take a try at some of the questions. Was one of them corporal punishment?
Oh, that's just one I've been asking for a few weeks now about, you know, what was given about corporal punishment, the comparison, or how black children are treated. But I asked today about Toya Graham, if people thought that was a reasonable comparison. Toya Graham, the black mother, mom of the year, beat her 16-year-old child who was participating allegedly in the rioting and looting after the suspicious death of Freddie Gray in Maryland. That was being compared to Adrian Peterson, the football player who was convicted of child abuse for beating his 6-year-old son for reportedly pushing his younger brother or other sibling. Is that a reasonable comparison, those two incidents?
I would say both incidents have their clear differences. I would say with the mom, with the teenager, she probably was more embarrassed than anything. and it was like a spur of the moment reaction, because I think she somehow understood that whatever that he was doing was a reflection somehow on her directly. And I think she understood that cameras were on her, or there were enough people that were around whenever she showed up, or maybe she was already there. I'm not sure on how she got in arm's distance of her child in that public setting. But I think it was more of a sense of embarrassment, and she reacted. And then again, I think I heard Thomas say something similar, because I've had it myself with my mom. I mean, how much damage, physical damage a mother could have with a 15-year-old boy anyway, you know, from that standpoint. I mean, there is some possibility if she had a Louisville Slugger bat in her hand and hit him in the back of the head or something like that, maybe, which she didn't. But that's basically what it was from that standpoint. I would say with Adrian Peterson, it probably was a part of anger, tradition, unfortunately. And actually, the tradition don't even come directly with non-white black people, at least in this part of the world. It's actually from the tradition that our white slave owners enacted upon us. And in turn, we continued the tradition. We continued the tradition based on the brain damage that they enacted even back before it was diagnosed as brain damage. I think I heard you recently say that some scientist somewhere regarded as brain damage as a result of it. Well, that brain damage was being occurring during the professional level of slavery that took place hundreds of years ago, that incurred, you know, even from back then, as far as the uncomparison between the two, I'll put it that way. Hopefully I'm making some sense. What else? Did I leave out something? Cause I have a tendency of talking and I forget.
No, I think that was the main one for this week, the comparison. I'm sure I'll probably ask a few others as we proceed.
Yeah, I would say from personal experience, though, last thing, I would say from personal experience, because out of my mother's five offspring, I was by far the toughest one to basically train. I received a lot of encounters with switches and belts and that sort of thing. And I would say in my opinion, it doesn't work. it doesn't really work. What really changed me, or whatever she saw in me that needed to be corrected, what caused that to take place was something else that she enacted, which is to have a concern for the other members of the care group. And where do you, retired firefighter, fit within that group? Are you doing the very best that you can do within this care group? And I said to myself emphatically at a certain point in time, from making a self-analysis, no, I'm not. And from there is what caused me to have a more constructive behavior. And that's it. Thank you.
Much obliged. Other folks dialed in, hand up if you have commentary to share. Proceed.
Yes. May I be heard?
Greetings, Mr. Demery Four. Yes, sir. Happy New Year, I guess, to all, if you all end all that.
Yes, Happy New Year. Greetings to the host, Gus, to the callers and listeners. I'll start out with part of the conclusion. You know, I was thinking the way that he wrote the book, the premise he made, you know, about black males and black boys, black men, black boys, the gender thing, the lack of any power on black masculinity. And then it said that the black scholar is rewarded for such hypothetical ventures that co-signed the disdain whites have for black men as violent, antisocial, dysfunctional, and so on. Black males are the depositories of the negativity traditionally associated with blackness that makes transcendence social, political, and conceptual possible for other black bodies. Hating them solidifies the class position and indicates the class aspiration of other blacks. So it seems that it's almost an acceptable practice, you know, to stereotype and to put all the negativity on black males. It seems to drive in this case, he's saying the black scholars, so all the theories and the premises that they're coming up with are based upon incorrect data, where they think that all black men are violent, and that that premise is not questioned and it's acceptable as true. And then so that if you got these dangerous black males and they lusting after power to dominate others, the book says, and the gender theory and popular intellectual work actually denied the intrinsic value of black male life and assessed that all social problems endured by or involving black men, whether their death at the hands of white police or vigilantes or the violence in their communities or homes, actually emanate from their nature. So it's almost like everything that happens to you as a black male, it basically comes back to you bringing upon yourself. Excuse me. You know, it's a pattern. It's just like there was a young man right there in Hollywood, I think, that, you know, a young black gay man was shot by a security guard working for Walmart. And this happened a few days ago. And they started talking about how the guy's, he's gay, he's homeless. They said he may have shoplift something, an item worth less than $3. He was shot from behind as he fled. So his The security guard took his life for less than $3. And so it's just the same thing. And they're concentrating on what the black fella did in order to bring this on himself, which nothing could amount to his life being taken. And then I'll say one thing about the difference in that comparison you had with, I think it was Adrian Peterson. He's disciplining his son. And I think in that case, that was a child that did not live in his present household. So, lack of another term, another baby mama brought him to visit Peterson in his home. So when he spanked him, those marks was on his leg when his mother picked him up. So she initiated the law enforcement upon that. That in a case where it's within your home, there's probably a lot of weps and little marks on little legs even today, because like Gus had pointed out, white people beat their kids too, you know. So but the difference in that and this lady that beat her son in the middle of the street in Baltimore is, that's two totally different things. And she even stated that she was going to teach her son. You can read the article, the footnotes, points to Stacey Patterson, who wrote the Washington Post article on why do we celebrate a mom, a black mom beating her kids, something to that effect. And she said she would teach him not to resist white supremacy because she didn't want him to end up like Gray. And she said it in a statement. And, you know, although that's incorrect and it was inappropriate for her to take that action in public like that, she gave her reason for that. And, you know, it was something totally different than what was being brought up. We were talking about black masculinity. And one last thing I will say. Okay, I'll be buying on that, Gus. Thanks for taking the call.
Much obliged, Mr. Demery Four. I'll see if I can find that report and share that one with listeners as we proceed. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, your line is open as well. Just, I did want to state really quick the comment about how much damage a female could do to a male. Dr. Curry does make a lot of explicit points about that in the text, including explicit cases of black females who did cause extensive damage, not to black boys, but to quote-unquote grown black males, like black males who were in their 30s, 40s, who were, you know, normal size, not disabled black males, where black females were able to inflict a substantial amount of damage, like requiring medical attention damage. I think some of us remember Tiger Woods, even though that was a white woman, cowbell, but she inflicted substantial damage. I think she did have a weapon, but yeah, I think he does make a big point about that in the book. And I would challenge pretty much anybody here, allow any female who Toya Graham looks like she weighs more than 150 pounds. Forgive me if I'm in error, but that's just my assessment from the video and images that I've seen. Female that weighs more than 150 pounds to hit you as hard as she can at least 5 times in the head. Anybody want to stand? Oh yeah, I got that. No problem. I will be the first to say, no, thank you. I am quite sure I've seen enough females 150 pounds and up who could inflict quite a bit of damage, striking as hard as they could for any reason. And to the head, oh yeah, substantial amount of damage. Other folks who dial, anybody who thinks I'm not being logical with that assessment, thinks Toya Graham is not under 50 pounds, make sure to share that as well. Other folks who dialed in that we've not heard from, hand up, line should be open.
Hello, may I be heard?
Greetings, Irie. Yes, ma'am.
Greetings, Gus, and greetings to everybody else on the line. Happy New Year. So with the lady that you just mentioned, I thought about Dr. Joy. I always mispronounce it. It's either DeGry or DeGru. But basically, she set up a scenario during a discourse where she said one of the things mothers do to sons a lot of times is black mothers to their sons is like talk them down or like do things that depreciate the abilities or the strengths that would appeal to white people about their sons. So in this case, I think the lady, instead of, you know, some type of verbal devaluing, she did it physically for the cameras, for the people to see, hey, look, I'm beating him for you, so you don't have to. I'm going to take care of it. I'm going to keep my little, you know, as you would say, my little nigger in line, so you don't have to. And something, I believe it was retired firefighter, just mentioned about black males and how there are all these setups for them to fail. The homosexual black male that was shot for the $3 of merchandise. And it brings me back to Dr. Joy when she mentions that cognitive dissonance, that's required. It, in my opinion, from my understanding, it's required in white supremacy in order to continue to nullify and castigate black men, especially once something has happened that is considered illegal or inappropriate or incorrect. They say, hey, look at you doing that thing you do, even though, you know, we put you in this situation. And as a caller said on this show a long time ago, it's these black males responding the best they can to the conditions that they're in. But no, my cognitive dissonance requires that I say it's you. And that is all I had to share for now. Thank you, everyone, and thank you, Gus. I'll mute my line.
Yes, ma'am. Good to hear from you. Happy New Year, whatever that means. Other folks who dialed in that we've not heard from, if you have commentary, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Greetings, Henry in Chicago.
Greetings, Gus, and greetings to all the callers and listeners. On page 198, the book states that many of the tropes surrounding black masculinity rely on the effect of a savage heterosexualism. For example, the longstanding myth of the black rapist depends entirely on the insatiable and violent lust by black men for women. Now, it kind of reminds me of the encouragement of black males to a more effeminate and all the way to a point of a homosexual nature for black men. I see in some schools, public schools, that they are teaching homosexuality, and in mostly schools that are predominantly, you know, filled with black children. So the only, I guess, in the white, you know, in white people's minds, the only way to civilize, quote unquote, the black male is to make him more effeminate or participate in, as Neely Fuller says, anti-sexual behavior. On page 200, it states that Contemporary gender theorists maintain that the only hope for black men and boys rely in reformulating black masculinity towards a feminist ethics. Same thought that I had with the other statement, making black males more effeminate and homosexual, just so, you know, just so they can be, you know, quote unquote civilized. And even at that point, they're still, they're still targets for death. I think a previous caller was mentioning about an example of a homeless, and I believe he said homosexual male who was shot because he was stealing something. Because not only are we rapists, but we are also thieves as well in the system of white supremacy. And in regards to your question with Toya Graham and the Adrian Peterson incident, there are some differences, but I think in this context of what Dr. Curry is saying, you know, he's just using this example of a non-white black parent disciplining their non-white black children. And the public response to these two incidents, and I think there is the connection there in regards to non-white parent, non-white children, and discipline. And it is in fact what Dr. Curry is saying on page 203 that that there is the public would definitely believe that the mothers have more of a right to discipline their children than the black male, since the black male is a savage and the black male cannot comprehend correctly on what is discipline and what is abuse. So I see the comparisons there, even though the situations are a little different, but I understand what Dr. Curry is doing in this particular instance. And retired firefighter had brought up an excellent point, and along with the female caller when she talked about Dr. Joy DeGruy's, and she Dr. Joy DeGruy has a theory about what we inherit from slavery, because of the fact that when you were talking about the study of corporal punishment causing brain damage, I think that is inherent in us because of the fact that we have been damaged psychologically from the abuse of slavery, and just overall the system of white supremacy has abused us psychologically. I myself do not believe that corporal punishment should be a normal form of discipline. I myself and BGQ do believe that corporal punishment is an option, but is an extreme option. So I don't believe it as a normal form of discipline. I don't think you should, you know, spank your children for little menial things and even things that, you know, normal kids would do. But, you know, at the same time, I do believe that it should be, you know, an extreme option that I'll probably use. So that's just, you know, kind of like what my take is on it. That's all I have right now. Be my line.
Much obliged, Henry in Chicago. See if I missed any folks. The number again, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Okay, I'll go ahead and share, making sure I didn't miss any folks, and then I'll check again after I share a few of the notes that I took from this week. There was so much use of the term lust. I was reminded of why we are reading this text to begin with. Pamela Evans Harris: black love is a revolutionary act, feverish for black males. They are criminal, thieves, lusting for power, and white women, feverish. All right, so notes that I took from this week. I thought it was a really important section where he says, while dismissed in name as racist, the sanctions used to police and terrorize black maleness are thought to be absolutely necessary given the gender predilection black men are asserted to have toward women. They're feverish. Let's see. He is quoting from Sylvia Winters, No Humans Involved, which is great. We talked about that last week. Norm Stamper said that enforcement officials would show up. Oh, nigger shooting, no humans involved, or apes. They would have lots of little acronyms, but not people. But he's quoting from her, and she says, the 1960s that impelled many black Americans out of the ghettos and into suburbs that made possible, therefore, the universal acclaim for the Cosby Huxtable TV family, who proved that some black Americans could aspire to and even be drawn inside the sanctified category of Americanness in its present form. Bill Cosby. I said he should be mentioned every week that we read this book, Bill Cosby. That right there is why I do not think it is a constructive investment of time and energy to attack other victims of racism and how they respond to the system of white supremacy. It just, in my view, it's not logical. And for that very reason, that is a sterling illustration. I shouldn't say sterling, but I think that is a classic illustration with William H. Cosby. It can look for a time as though Mr. Cosby or whomever else you would like to pick out has the acclaim of whites and proved that he and maybe a few other Negroes can aspire to and even be drawn inside the sanctified category of Americanness, whiteness in its present form. But believe you me, buddy, if you are not white, whites can remind you and remove you really quick. I mean, wow. No one can remind you faster than whites. And because of that, in my view, it just doesn't make sense. What you need to remember, we're in a system of racism, white supremacy, and regardless of what they allow a nigger to do or to have, all of that can be rebuked in the next like 30 seconds as long as we're in a system of racism, white supremacy. That is most important, not criticizing what they did to get that extra bit of cornbread or how long they got to have it or why they said this or anything else. We're still in a system of racism, white supremacy, just following logic. Oh, and in the same line, he says the ascendancy of specific classes of black Americans, those black Americans who aspire to be seen as different from those not humans or those niggers, has been achieved through neglecting the death of black men and boys and embracing nigrophobia. The manifestation of nigrophobic sentiment in the writing and scholarship of black intellectuals is institutionally rewarded, and I stop right there. That's all I highlighted. Institutionally rewarded. That is the most important aspect. Institutionally rewarded by whom? The only institution that I am aware of in the known universe is the institution of white supremacy. That would be whites are rewarding this behavior, maybe requiring this behavior if you want to be a black intellectual. If not, we got to jumpsuit in the prison cell right next to old William H. And, you know, you all can hang out and share ideas about, you know, niggers, coloring books, whatever else, Jell-O pudding pops, whatever else comes to mind. Let me know if I'm talking nutty. Continuing. Wow, the section in the conclusion of chapter 5 I thought was really important. I don't want to read the whole portion that I highlighted, but one, Frank Wilderson, multiple time guest on the program, Context of White Supremacy. Oh, and there it is again. There it is again. The black scholar is rewarded for such hypothetical venues that cosign, who says that, the disdain whites have for black men as violent, antisocial, dysfunctional, and so on. Black males are the depositories of the negativity traditionally associated with blackness. caller already mentioned that hating them solidifies the class position and indicates the class aspirations of other blacks. Again, none of this would be possible. These aspirations have to be rewarded, affirmed by dot, dot, dot. Let's see. I do think this point is so hugely important. We talked about it previously, but this is in the conclusion, so he's summarizing here. But where he says, just as white masculinity and femininity were symbiotic relations that reified similar values, political goals, and aspirations specifically on matters of race, so too did black masculinity and femininity overlap historically, endorsing the same values, political goals, and aspirations. I think that is hugely important. He goes on to say the very next sentence. How does it start? This is not to say that there are no differences within these groups. Da, da, da. He goes on to say quite a bit, but it's so important because I hear that frequently. It's 2019 is early, but I'm sure I'll hear it again. But I heard it throughout 2018. And I've heard it for the 10 years that we've been on. People speaking as though there are astronomical differences in how black males and black females think and or thought and or have been conditioned, brain trashed by the system of white supremacy. And that is not true. Yes, you see differences. There are differences between how black males think about racism. Not all black females think the same about this, but there is a lot of overlap in how we have responded, how we've been conditioned quite a bit. Certainly more so than I generally hear. It's generally as though there is, you know, totally different perspective on how we're thinking about this or how we've been conditioned, particularly on the latter, how we have been conditioned to think and respond by the system of racism, white supremacy. Let's see. Dr. Joy DeGruy, multiple time guest on The Cows as well, met her in person at the White Privilege Conference number 10 in Wisconsin, of all places. Continuing, let's see. Thought it was an important point where he says black nationalism was not a reaction black men had as humans to their unbridled murder at the hands of whites, their rape by white men or women, or their economic oppression. It was only their pursuit of power so that they could take their place alongside white males. They are thought only to be violent, the largest killers of themselves, and abusive to all those around them. Great point. And again, I've heard that articulated like recently, that, yeah, we do not endorse black nationalism. I think that was a sentiment that was expressed by Black Lives Matter Toronto, that they, you know, break explicitly with that whole tradition of black nationalism because of that exactly. It's all about black macho and black masculinity, that this is a consistent theme expressed about black males. Let's see. I thought this was important as well. I think some of this is a bit more accessible. I know some of the previous chapters, a lot of academic jargon, not as accessible. This, a lot of this seems distilling, making it a bit more simple. He says, this violent black masculinity is thought to be irredeemable through its own faculties. In other words, black masculinity is permanently stained, a defect akin to original sin. Contemporary gender theorists maintain that the only hope for black men and boys lies in reformulating black masculinity toward a black feminist ethics. And I've heard that explicitly stated by many, that, you know, black manhood, black masculinity, all of it is so defective and corrosive that it just needs to be trashed, and black males reimagining themselves in a more feminine manner. I've almost heard it articulated in that way, specifically, explicitly. I thought it was really important in pointing that out, that there are quote unquote healthy, whatever that means in the system, manifestations of black masculinity that are not about dominating and mistreating others, that are about trying as best we can to replace the system with justice. They are not anti-black female. They are not about harming children, that there are examples of that. And that just gets ignored. And again, why are we reading this book? why did I have such a problem with Black Love is a Revolutionary Act? The Black male figure that stood out most in terms of representation that I'm remembering was Dennis Rodman. In terms of why.
Muted. Unmuted.
Again, if folks could remember to use their mute button. Some of the representations of Black males that were used in the text. Do I think Dennis Rodman is representative of the typical Black male experience 2019 or 21st century? No. And some of the other examples that were chosen in the book as well. But continuing, let's see. I'll pick out a few other notes that I had from this week's section. And then if other folks have comments or questions, we will hear from you briefly. And then we'll get to the second audio segment. Let's see. Oh, in fact, the last comment I'll read is not even from the text. This will be from aforementioned Black Love is a Revolutionary Act. And I also mentioned, even while iTunes was not cooperating, has been updated. It's almost current, but I was able to get a lot of content uploaded today. SoundCloud, I think current for the moment. I think SoundCloud is current with content. Black Love is a Revolutionary Act. All of the archives from that book study are available at SoundCloud. And I think all of that is at iTunes now as well. But some of the commentary from SoundCloud. So I read the first one before. Person wrote, a woman wants to feel, be protected by her man, period, man. You can't say Black men can't defend their women because of racism, but then say Black Love is a Revolutionary Act. What woman wants to be in a relationship with a man that can't be protected? Now, I talked about this before in terms of just following logic, some aspects of this. It seems like maybe this person is confused, confused about many things. I guess we can start with number one, man. Talked about that so many times and apropos for this book, The Man Not. And again, Mr. Fuller, fundamental aspect of code, Black males, Black females. We do not qualify as men and women under the system of white supremacy. And when I see people who don't even have that understanding, I almost am ready to stop right there because it's not a whole lot we're going to be able to discuss in an intelligent, logical manner. So that's one. Continuing, you can't say Black men can't defend their women. Stop right there. Either we are or we're not in a system of white supremacy. Some of this is just, it's basics. If we are in a system of white supremacy, then it's not possible for Black males to protect, defend, whatever word you want to use, if we are indeed in a system of white supremacy and vice versa. This is just the logistics of the world we're in. Either it is or it ain't. Continuing, and then say Black Love is a Revolutionary Act. That's why I said there's massive confusion because that's just the title of the book. That's not my endorsement. That's just the title of the book. What woman wants to be in a relationship with a man that can't protect? Now, again, now that's just understanding the logics of racism. Now, if you want to be with someone who can protect you, no argument there. But that would mean understanding the system of white supremacy. I don't know that such a person exists. The only person that would leave would be racist man. How protected, quote unquote, are you going to be with racist man? Again, this is just understanding logics. Either what I'm saying is accurate or it is not. Now, I wrote my response. I'm following logic. That's what I'm reading. If there's a system of white supremacy, are Black males capable of protecting anyone, including themselves? If the answer is yes, where is the evidence? I consistently hear people talk about Black females being raped during slavery and Black males being helpless to respond. The title of the book is Black Love is a Revolutionary Act. That's not my personal statement. That's all I said. So she responded a while later. There are millions of Black men in America and billions worldwide. So you can't tell me Black men are not capable of protecting themselves if you join together and fight back. Now, again, either we are in a system of white supremacy or we are not. She continues. What it sounds like to me is Black men are enjoying their position being submissive to white men and Asian men. Again, how is Black Love a Revolutionary Act when the men aren't even men? If Black men can't lead the way, then why should any woman want to be with one? Black men enjoy sitting back while Black women take the lead and defend our community, then get mad and say Black women are too strong and manly. It's a man's job to defend their community, or the community will perish. The only thing black love, in quotes, does for black women is leave them broken, beat down, overweight, and not an object of desire for any man, because they have to worry about being a warrior over being a woman. VGQ, I will say, it is not black love, in my opinion. It is the system of racism, white supremacy, that leaves them and many black males broken, beat down, overweight, and not an object of desire for anyone. That is the system of white supremacy. And again, that is exactly why the first page of Mr. Fuller's book is, if you don't understand the system of racism, white supremacy, what it is, how it works, everything else will confuse you. And so much of this, it just comes back to fundamentals. What does the system of white supremacy mean? With that, I will pause because the second audio segment is a little lengthy. Let me see just how lengthy it is. Oh, we will push off right now. So this is audio segment number two, context of white supremacy. So we are in the conclusion. Dr. Curry continues with his summary of the text. If you have additional comments on what's been shared, just jot down a note, pull out your mobile device, or you can be prehistoric and grab a actual pencil and pad and make a note, and we will be back to share very soon. Context of white supremacy, the man knot, audio segment number two. It was not so long ago that Judith Butler warned feminism about simply picking and choosing incidents as proof of a universal theory of patriarchy. Butler maintained that the urgency of feminism to establish a universal status for patriarchy in order to strengthen the appearance of feminism's own claims to be representative has occasionally motivated the shortcut to a categorical or fictive universality of the structure of domination held to produce women's common subjugated experience. Despite the theorizations around performativity, the idea that man is defined as the external negation of the female and thereby concretizes gender based on this biological difference remains affixed in many accounts of black masculinity. In the same way that Oyorinke Oyewimu warns us that the biolization of the woman is used to explain the cultural and social inequality of the female sex, we can also see that the sexual confinement of a body to that of male remains conceptually predetermined by the assumed biologism of white Western imperial masculinity that insists on patriarchal violence to enforce the social order. Oyewimu's understanding of the gaze as an invitation to differentiate is relevant here. Black males are not studied because they are intuitively grasped as problems. Maurice O. Wallace describes this concern as the reckless racial eyeballing of black male embodiment. When imposed on the black male body, the gaze of others tends toward monocularity, meaning that one's sight can fixate itself on only one aspect of that which is seen. In the case of the black male, this perception leads toward negativity and the accentuation of colonial phallic myths to explain his relation to the other. The phobias perceived, the inhumanity and savageness of black males, presume the genital, sexual, nigger as its origin. Wallace thus restates Oyewimu's problem of the body as that of representation, or how that which is seen by the observer is perceived through fixed, overdetermined aspects of the object itself. Wallace thus concludes, for the black male, there is a need for the end of monocularity, which is his metaphor for a single mode of colonial supervision maintained in the evil eye of objectification. The black male is known by, trapped within, a pathological epistemology that intuitively assigns all forms of evil to him as if these attributes are, in fact, knowledge about him. Gender, then, becomes a placeholder for the assumed sexual dominance of man over woman rather than a contextual rendering of various differences and the consequences of those differences on bodies and historical relations between those bodies. Gender theory, then, fulfills its aim insofar as it announces the woman as the substantive product of gender and masculinity as its negating apparatus. In short, gender theory is offered not as an explication of the various expressions of male and female bodies in relation to their particular society or culture, but as the construction of a theorizable subject, the woman, and that which must be conceptually suppressed because it negates her, the man. The cultural theorist and ethnomusicologist Miles White makes a similar point, saying, while it is also the case that women's studies and gender studies began largely as a way to include the women's excluded histories, gender studies cannot or should not preclude the study of men if only to interrogate the presumptions of male privilege. The assertion becomes even more problematic when we think of the peculiar position of black males in American society. Ronald Jackson stresses that under our present regime of gender theory, specifically the assumptions of feminism, black men are thought to be purely negative and antagonistic entities despite the presence of viable, healthy, and actual black masculinities. Feminist thinkers who encapsulate and hold liable negative masculine tendencies for the American fixation on power, competition, greed, control, and institutionalized exclusion have inspired a large segment of critical masculinity scholarship. Consequently, the versions of masculinity that are described are often culturally generic, fragmented, and aloof. There are very few gender studies that depict masculinities as positive, healthy, mature, productive, and balanced identities, but these masculinities do exist. The gender descriptors masculinity or masculinist usually refer to antagonistic, puerile, insecure, very unaware, and chaotic male identities. It is true that masculine, like feminine, persons enact a wide range of behaviors on a daily basis, from dysfunctional to quite functional. So theorizing masculinities in terms of a gendered continuum ranging from healthy to unhealthy and positive to negative self-definitions is both necessary and revolutionary. As mentioned previously, the everyday existence of healthy and productive human beings is not so new, which means that there has been slippage in some gender theories with respect to how they account for healthy masculinities. Because black masculinity, the category itself, represents an infinite monolith, the endless, innocuous potentials and despotic possibilities of the black male that drive him to conquer those weaker than he. Any attempt to think of black masculinity as healthy or nonviolent is formulated as black men embracing something like the feminine or the not masculine. The ontology of black masculinity is thought of as pure negativity, so thinking that uses such a concept demands the thinker externalize any positive or desirable characteristics of black males as their rejection of masculinity rather than as the substance of a black masculinity itself. Since we define black masculinity as condemnable, anything that we find worthwhile does not belong to the actualization of something in black males. Instead, it is something they embrace as outside themselves. In this way, progressive pro-woman black masculinities are thought to originate in thinking that problematizes black masculinity, not the awareness and thought of black males' consciousness about the world surrounding him. Gender theories asserting that masculinity is synonymous with patriarchy obfuscate attempts to theoretically engage black manhood and boyhood as it exists in the world outside the presumed relation of white gendered domination and racism. Despite post-structural and intersectional gender theories that claim to recognize the difference between black men and boys' material actualities and white patriarchy, black men and boys remain confined to biological fixations that make their sexual designations synonymous with their gendered aspiration for power over others. We have arrived at a time of theory in which black males are thought to be privileged even as they are the overwhelming victims of various systems and bodies in society. Even in their victimization, their unjust incarceration, death, poverty, and absence in institutions of higher education, black males are thought to be a threat to themselves and society. While the amelioration of these conditions is claimed to be part of anti-racist advocacy, the stigma associated with an ontological view of black masculinity would still hold that achieving this goal, saving their lives, would ultimately allow them to harm other men, women, and children in their communities. In this way, the oppression of black men serves a prophylactic function in the minds of theorists who hold the ontological view of black masculinity, because if black males were free, they would seek only to harm or dominate all others they would engage. As Ronaldo Walcott observes, the representation of black masculinity as in need of repair and rescue is not merely internal to the U.S. conversation. It leaks across borders. In the context of neoliberalism's production of wasted populations in a law-likely fashion, black masculinity has globally come under new kinds of cultural policing. This policing of black masculinity exists apositionally between the force of the prison and the legitimizing rationalizations of such force originating in the academy. Drawing from Stuart Hall's analysis of the managerialism within academic neoliberalism, Walcott continues, conversations concerning black manhood are premised on neoliberalism's new managerial regime in which black masculinities are understood to be underperforming, in need of programs of efficiency and better management. Such is particularly so for poor, redundant, and wasted masculinities that appear to have nothing to contribute to the global engines of capitalism. In this instance, managerialism as both discourse and practice seeks to control and conduct how these wasted persons, often reduced only to a body, might be understood in the light of the numerous contradictions that plague the wealthy West. the discursive production and reproduction of Black masculinity legitimized under the guise of theoretical innovation within and across disciplines still hold to the racial stereotypes that flourish throughout society. The view that Black males are aggressive, dangerous to women, and prone to violence is the same one that police, courts, and vigilantes use to excuse the violence leveraged against these disposable entities to keep them in their place. In the university, however, holding such views is absolved of racism when presented as Black masculinity. Because Black masculinity exists as theory, the construct that names the character of the bodies and predilections of the heterosexual Black male is thought of not as racism or misandry against this disadvantaged group, but rather as progressivism. It is often accepted as a necessary corrective not only to Black males' presence in the university, but also in terms of threats they pose to society more generally. Advocated as gender progressivism, Black masculinity is problematized not only conceptually, but also corporeally, thereby recreating the disappearance of work with which Black males are currently confronted. Within the academic enterprise, scholars market themselves as managers of this population and their work as the inoculation against their spread. Departments and hiring committees routinely rationalize not hiring Black men using this logic of diversity, or more accurately, the logic of the presumed threat Black males hires pose to women and other groups. It is in this moment that managers are called on to rationalize their discrimination through an appeal to theory. Black male privilege now becomes a rationale that discourages remedying Black male underrepresentation by focusing on Black males' undesirability, a trope deployed by liberals as a way to justify discriminating against Black men. In fact, cohorts of scholars are identified as marketable precisely by the extent to which they argue Black masculinity must be avoided. Such a stance identifies not only the labor of this academic class, but also their bodies as distant and unsympathetic to the empirical realities and disciplinary erasure of Black men and boys. These are progressive scholars, or scholars who are able to increase their worth within the university by supporting theories of Black masculinity that legitimize and justify the fears society has of Black men and boys more generally. Although intersectional methodology claims not only to be aware of the unique position of Black males, but also analytically competent in the fundamental difference that race, class, and gender establish between Black maleness and what historically has been understood as white male patriarchy, contemporary gender conceptualizations of Black masculinity within these theories still insist that all maleness is committed to attaining patriarchy regardless of race or class location. In the schema, race merely expresses the degree to which one manifests the power or privileges of white masculinity and patriarchy writ large. It does not describe Black males' cultural or material distance from the historical power and antagonistic will of white males. In other words, race serves to indicate the degree to which one may express the capacity of patriarchy, maleness, but it does not mark the modal limit of patriarchy itself. Whereas that which is female is thought to be conceptually and biologically distinct from patriarchy, despite being formulated, historically situated, and geographically located in many cases at the helm of empire, colonialism, militarism, corporatism, and classism, the sexual designation of female, meaning not male, intuitively marks a modal boundary that indicates the absence of patriarchy. This intersectional, categorical modality conceptualizes Black masculinity as othered within white masculinity, patriarchy, man, whereas that which is female is othered without and thereby separated and distanced from man patriarchy altogether. Intersectionality's Black Male Problem, Dominance Theory as Intersectional Anthropology. Intersectionality is thought to be the most visible and promising theoretical innovation of Black feminism of the 20th and 21st centuries. At a theoretical level, it is argued that intersectionality can be applied to any number of subjects: Black men, Black queer identity, women of color throughout the world, disability, and so on. This theoretical novelty is commonly tied to Kimberly Crenshaw's first exploration of the idea in Demarginalizing the Intersection of Race and Sex, a Black Feminist Critique of Anti-Discrimination Doctrine, Feminist Theory, and Anti-Racist Politics. In the article, Crenshaw is specifically concerned with Black women's experience of discrimination. She argues Black women sometimes experience discrimination in ways similar to white women's experiences. Sometimes they share very similar experiences with Black men. Yet often they experience double discrimination, the combined effects of practices which discriminate on the basis of race and on the basis of sex. And sometimes they experience discrimination as Black women, not the sum of race and sex discrimination, but as Black women. In her subsequent article, Mapping the Margins, Intersectionality, Identity Politics, and Violence Against Women of Color, written 2 years after her introduction on intersectionality as an analytic concept, she attempts to expand intersectionality as a method particular to Black women to one peculiar to the experiences and history of women of color generally regarding access to domestic violence resources. Whereas Demarginalizing the Intersection of Race and Sex argued for an experiential epistemological foundation of race, sex, in the body of the Black woman as a protected class within the law, Mapping the Margins maintained that Crenshaw's focus on the intersections of race and gender only highlights the need to account for multiple grounds of identity when considering how the social world is constructed. In an effort to establish a grounding for intersectionality, Crenshaw articulates two aspects of her theory: a structural intersectionality that considers the material effects of various social stratifications, which for her thinking about domestic violence were poverty and women of color's access to shelters, and a political intersectionality that highlights the fact that women of color are situated within at least two subordinated groups that frequently pursue conflicting political agendas. Crenshaw maintains that the need to split one's political energies between two sometimes opposing groups is a dimension of intersectional disempowerment that men of color and white women seldom confront. The exact disadvantages men of color, specifically heterosexual Black males, confront seems largely absent in intersectionality theory. Some intersectionality thinkers assert that Black males have privilege and advantages over Black women because they are male. Others suggest that while Black men are shown to be the greatest victims of incarceration and police brutality, the attention to their suffering excludes the suffering of Black women, as well as that of Black gay and lesbian groups. Devon Carbado observes, heterosexual Black men occupy a privileged victim status in anti-racist discourse. For heterosexual Black males, intersectionality insists that both Black male advantage and disadvantage over other groups is male privilege. On the one hand, a heterosexual Black man's advantages over Black women or Black gay men and lesbians in terms of income could be evidence of his patriarchal privilege as a straight Black man, while on the other hand, his relative disadvantage to white men and women, and sometimes Black women, regarding unemployment, incarceration, and homicide is that same patriarchal privilege because he draws attention away from other victimizations. In the latter case, Carbado frames this as a problem of focus. As a result of this focus on Black men, without a similar focus on Black women, Black men are perceived to be significantly more vulnerable and significantly more endangered than Black women. How can Black male vulnerability be adequately engaged theoretically under such a paradigm when every insistence of Black men's disparate suffering and victimization is morally condemnable as the erasure of another group, even in cases such as police brutality and incarceration, where Black men are, in actual fact, overwhelming the greatest casualties of these encounters? Throughout various publications, scholars use intersectionality to suggest that Black males share the same proclivities as white males or patriarchs, even in their disadvantage to this dominant group. Crenshaw's development of intersectionality was inspired in part by the dominance theory of female subordination offered by Catherine MacKinnon. The law, like the society it reflects, establishes patterns of inferiority and power asymmetry between men and women. Women are dominated as women. This is not simply an essentialist argument for MacKinnon, since she believes that what makes the particular subject vulnerable is shared sexual vulnerability to male dominance. When the Reconstruction Amendments gave Blacks the vote, and Black women still could not vote, weren't they kept from voting as women? When African American women are raped 2 times as often as white women, aren't they raped as women? That does not mean that their race is irrelevant, and it does not mean that their injuries can be understood outside a racial context. Rather, it means that sex is made up of the reality of the experiences of all women, including theirs. It is a composite unit rather than a divided unitary whole, such that each woman, in her way, is all women. Crenshaw recognizes that such politicized accounts of sameness that rely on the vulnerability of the woman, especially in the case of rape and domestic abuse, can obscure other such realities, such as that of male victims or same-sex relationships. She seems aware that theories of women's subordination, as well as the interventions that such theories anticipate, will obviously exclude subjects whose context are not anticipated, accommodated, or recognized. However, she seems hesitant to think of these relations of women beyond the events missed that delineate Black women from white. She resists the more radical decentering of gender as a marker of white anthropology because the idea of woman carries a notable political currency. While Crenshaw has acknowledged the non-universality of categories such as woman, she fails to inquire into the limits that such a category imposes on the normative operation of man within the theory. under the intersectional frame to say that the female is subordinated on the basis of sex presumes the sameness of men because the black male, like the white male, does not suffer from sexual subordination. The recognition of multiple subordinations brings with it the assertion of multiple causes for said subordination. At the level of identity, the black male, in his exception as male, is found to enjoy the privilege of not being sexed and therefore not vulnerable like the female. But this conclusion results from a rendering of the very subjects and their histories, Crenshaw has acknowledged, are excluded in politicized calls to sameness. The centering of the black woman as sexually vulnerable, the symbolic representation of race and sex, and the violence of rape and domestic abuse, by consequence, exclude black males from being seen as vulnerable. The centering of the black female subject implies that, because of his maleness, the black male is always dominant because of patriarchy, not vulnerable to it. Crenshaw's system thereby links the exclusion of black women from anti-racist movements to the same operating patriarchal norms of the larger society. The subordinated male, then, is hegemonic because he strives for recognition as subordinated at the expense of the black female, yet such designations do not apply in the case of sexual violence, such as rape, because, for Crenshaw, male dominance is enforced with the erasure of black women from anti-racism, while there is no female dominance operating in the erasure of black men as sexual victims. Under this paradigm, an implicit biologism is operating at the level of theory that defines black maleness as not sexed and hence normative alongside the structural operation of patriarchy, while the black woman, as sexed and raced, nuances the substance of the woman. There is an eerie continuity between pre-intersectional feminist analysis of black males and the intersectional era that many scholars now suggest benefits from the cultural and conceptual insights of the theory. Despite the decades between McKinnon's thinking about black men and Crenshaw's, it seems that intersectionality has done little to complicate how black men are seen politically and economically when related to black women. In 1979, McKinnon argued, when black women enter the labor market of the dominant society, they succeed to the secondary place of white females, remaining, in addition, under the disabilities of blacks, while black men succeed at least to some of the power of the male role. Indeed, many of the demands of the black civil rights movement in the 1960s centered upon just such a recovery of manhood. Where would McKinnon get such an idea in 1979? She offered no footnote to substantiate empirically her assertion that black men's biological sex, maleness, was enough to confer concrete economic and political benefits in the workplace. Although she was writing only a few years after the creation of affirmative action and a little more than a decade after the Civil Rights Act was passed, she asserted that black men had already achieved and solidified male privilege. While McKinnon did offer the prefatory disclaimer that racism does not allow black men to share white men's dominance of economic resources, she also asserted that maleness was recognized and advantaged in the workplace. In fact, she went as far to suggest that because of race, black men enjoyed the benefit of dissuading white women from claiming sexual harassment in the workplace. Some white women confide that they have consciously resisted reporting severe sexual harassment by black men authorities because they feel the response would be supportive for racist reasons. McKinnon argued, although racism is deeply involved in sexual harassment, The element common to these incidents is that the perpetrators are male, the victims female. Despite racism, McKinnon asserted that, in economic and political matters, the access to manhood black men had recently gained because of civil rights meant that power primarily revolved around the male-female axis. It transformed a Jim Crow context in which white women viewed accusing black men of rape as a racial obligation into a post-civil rights context in which, because of gender, white women became hesitant to accuse black men of harassment. For McKinnon, gender expresses the hierarchical distance between the male sex and the female sex. Gender emerges as the congealed form of the sexualization of inequality between men and women. So long as this is socially the case, the feelings or acts or desires of particular individuals, notwithstanding gender inequality, will divide their society into two communities of interest. Instead of describing habits of performance or the consequences of sexual differentiation between bodies, gender becomes the consequence of male power over the female. It emerges as that which names this particular asymmetry. McKinnon goes as far as to suggest that gender inequality is sustained by the sexual pleasure the male gains from the subjugation of the female. This view holds that aggression against those with less power is experienced as sexual pleasure for the masculine gender, while the female is defined by submissiveness. Race and the brute reality of racism do little to alter the function of gender within this schema. Intersectionality and hegemonic masculinity. While contemporary intersectionality theorists argue that the theory can and, in fact, does apply to black males, there has been no critical interrogation of the role dominance theory plays in explaining or defining heterosexual black male behavior under intersectionality. For example, Frank Rudy Cooper's Against Bipolar Black Masculinity, Intersectionality, Assimilation, Identity, Performance, and Hierarchy asserts that the analysis of black male bipolarity, the oscillation between the good black and the bad black male image, is an intersectional phenomenon because it is the product of the combination of narratives about blackness in general and narratives about black masculinity in particular. At the same time, however, he asserts that heterosexual black men, good and bad, are seduced into taking pleasure in the present hierarchies. Despite their material location, in prison or in the boardroom, heterosexual black men are taught to emulate the economically empowered heterosexual white men who set the norms in this culture. Using Michael Kimmel's essay, Masculinity as Homophobia, Cooper interprets Raewyn Connell's theory of hegemonic masculinity to conclude the predominant account of normative United States masculinity describes it as fundamentally based on a fear of being associated with denigrated others. To be a full man, one must distinguish oneself from femininity. One accomplishes that by distancing himself from the qualities associated with women and from women themselves. Instead, one treats women as possessions to be displayed as evidence of one's manhood. Similarly, one must distance oneself from gay men. This is the attempted repudiation of the presence of feminine qualities in men. Kimmel cites Connell's gender and power to explain hegemonic masculinity as the image of masculinity of those men who hold power. According to Kimmel, we equate manhood with being strong, successful, capable, reliable, in control. In fact, it is these definitions of manhood that are used to maintain the power that some men have over other men and that men have over women. As discussed previously, These notions simply do not apply to racially subordinated males who are targeted by white patriarchy. As decades of data have suggested, black men and boys simply do not see masculinity either as the ideal for which one should strive or as synonymous with black manhood. Cooper argues that heterosexual black men seek to emulate this normative white masculinity, making them feel compelled to prove their manhood through acts that distance them from marginalized others. Perhaps most interesting, he maintains that intersectional disadvantage does not change the impulse of the heterosexual male. Despite their condition or circumstances, heterosexual black men will seek to offset their feelings of powerlessness by subordinating others. This explanation highlights the difference between the application of a theory and anthropological assumptions behind a theory. Cooper argues that intersectionality helps us understand the identity level tensions and conflicts between black men being designated as good or bad in a white supremacist society, but behind the analysis of identity is an assumption about the nature of heterosexual black men. Cooper's claim does not emerge from any historical or empirical study of heterosexual black males, but from the familiarity this narrative has among gender theorists. His reputation of the consensus concerning black males held by his audience. Cooper only cites the anecdotal analysis bell hooks offers of black males' political aspirations after emancipation. While Hooks admits that newly freed black men and women were both struggling with the contradictions of gender in which black women demanded that black men protect and provide for them, it is only black men in their struggle to fulfill this role and be recognized as men who are deemed patriarchs. Like Michelle Wallace, Hooks is unable to conceptualize non-feminist-inspired black masculinities, especially after racial integration. She assumes that the history of black gender relations can be told as one that conceptualizes black womanhood as participating in sexism, but is much less innocuous in its reproduction of patriarchy than black males, while the political struggles of black men are primarily mimetic and motivated by their desire to dominate others. Since Hooks provides no citations to substantiate her interpretation of heterosexual black men's 150-year struggle for freedom in this country, the reader is expected to accept Cooper's understanding of the black male personality based solely on the authoritative force of bell hooks' pronouncement. Regardless of their location, heterosexual black men, because they are male, are thought always to aspire to the characteristics of white bourgeois masculinity. Even in those cases where the black male is shown to be materially oppressed, Cooper asserts black males will subordinate others to compensate for the power they lack. In all cases, the fundamental nature of the black male, whether he has power or not, is to dominate other men and women. Intersectionality theorists have been able to consistently conflate the question of whether the method can be applied to heterosexual black males with the assumptions the method holds about heterosexual black males. Similar criticisms against Crenshaw's intersectional view of masculinity have previously been made. The legal theorist Angela Harris, for example, has explained that the fact that men are divided by race, ethnicity, religion, class, and sexual orientation means that there is not just one kind of masculinity. Harris's point demands a conceptualizing of differing ends and desires of these multiple masculinities, something that is currently ignored by scholars applying intersectionality to black males. In the work of intersectionality theorists such as Cooper, all masculinity tends toward domination and subjugation. This is an essential nature found in the category of male. Since slavery, there has been a well-documented history of gratuitous violence in which white patriarchal societies against males of the subordinate racial group that has prevented the participation and integration of those males into mainstream society. Anthony J. Lamell Jr.'s Black Masculinity and Sexual Politics argues that an anti-black male ontology justifying the exacting of brutality and murder against black males as a group has always been central to the anti-black racist program of America, so much so that black males have never been considered or defined as males such that they could be viable partners in the white patriarchal endeavor. Black male experience is a condition of victimization by white patriarchy, not the basis of emulation of it. Lamell argues for an understanding of black maleness, the experience of the subordinate position, as an anthropological and historical condition created by the political, legal, and economic institutions of the United States to define black males as savage and position these bodies in relation to jurisdictional structures and institutions that hasten death as a display of white male power and white racial order. American society was organized around the subjugation of subordinate racialized males. Lamell argues that black male subjugation is prior to black men's experiencing of it. It is a structural dynamic built into white patriarchal societies that preceded the full development of a dominant culture that functioned to gag the legitimate aspirations of the black internally colonized. The West could not have thought of blacks as patriarchal equals given the function of race in its historical system of norms and roles. The black subalterns were educated in self-hate under the logic of white citizenship theory by the dominant political class, the co-opted leadership from among the black masses, as well as privileged stratified fractions of other tormented aggregates that were hierarchically organized in U.S. cultural imperialism. In other words, the organization of imperialism through colonial-like technologies does not develop at a certain phase of black male experience. The colonial-like technologies are, to the contrary, organizationally first in time to assist in the assurance that black males are a criminal or at least a deviant class of citizen. The ideologies supporting this organization offer a rationale for treating black males differently. Lamell offers a penetrating analysis that highlights the gap that exists between black male victimization and the alleged socialization of black males into patriarchy. The black male is not born with the expectation that he will elevate to the ranks of white males. Rather, he is socialized under a racial order that denies that the racialized subordinate black male can expect any class mobility. He is defined as deviant and criminal precisely because this position as antithetical and dangerous to the order of civil society makes him discernible. The tremendous amount of violence committed against him as a black male is normalized and often challenged by academics and policymakers as irrelevant. It is this normality of his death, the negotiation of what his life could have meant when compared with other human lives, that indicates that he is beyond the specter of humanity. The fact that this violence is normalized, even when it fundamentally exceeds the level of brutality against any other human beings or citizens in the same society, is evidence of the dehumanized station black men and boys are determined by in this country. As Lamell correctly insists, the cultural domination of black males means that power relationships prevent understanding gender as a straightforward cultural reality where it either signifies female or male statuses. There are, in fact, equivocal gender statuses and consequently various masculinities. Under intersectionality, the disadvantages of Black men are conceptualized as consequences of the racial category, not the gendered subordinate male category, since male is thought of only as a designation of privilege. If gender is not categorical, meaning that it cannot be understood as tending to one sort of experience or structural position, what is the basis for the assumption that because someone is male, he aspires to hegemonic masculinity? Why is gender not, as in the case of subordinate male, the basis of anti-patriarchal culture and positionality? In other words, where does this impetus to pursue patriarchy come from if the biological and cultural basis of gender are distorted? Because someone is male, he aspires to hegemonic masculinity. Why is gender not, as in the case of subordinate male, the basis of anti-patriarchal culture and positionality? In other words, where does this impetus to pursue patriarchy come from if the biological and cultural basis of gender are distorted?
The cows. That will do it. We will conclude next Thursday, all done with Dr. Tommy J. Curry's The Man Knot, Race, Class, Genre, and the Dilemmas of Black Manhood. If you have thoughts, questions, thinking about concluding sentiments for the text, the number 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. All done next Friday. Final thoughts, summations, if you have questions, things that stood out, major takeaways from the text. Next Thursday. We will wrap everything up. Let's see if I have any. I will just get to the folks who dialed in. If you dialed in, if we didn't hear from you at all and you know you have a question or a comment, you should definitely get your hand up now, *61, if you would like to participate. All the folks who dialed in with a hand up, line should be open. Feel free to share.
Fabio?
Greetings, Thomas in New York.
Greetings again, Gus. Well, I had a few comments to make. First one from last week, when we had the discussion about mental illness as far as suicides. You know, when I worked at the hospital, I would work in the psych ward sometimes in the psych ER. More so in the psych ER than the psych ward. And someone tried to kill themselves. They came to the hospital. They went right to the psych ER and to the psych ward. It's treated as a psychiatric, you know, condition. It's not normal for someone to want to kill themselves. If someone said they wanted to kill themselves that was a patient in the hospital or harm themselves, even an employee in the hospital.
How long is this anecdote going to be? Like, because I'm not... People do long stories that are kind of tangents from the text, and that I really want to try to avoid that.
I won't say anything. No problem. I had a few things to say, but obviously you don't. All right.
I mean, if you had things related to the text, let's hear it. But, I mean, this is like a workplace racism.
It was related to the text because last week.
I remember that, but, I mean, that's what I said about the length of the anecdote. I remember us talking about mental health.
Well, I was about to finish it, but I'll go to something else. Back to the text this week. 150-pound woman hit in a 16-year-old upside the head compared to a 235-pound all-muscle world-class athlete beat in a 6-year-old with a whip. A switch. I've been hit with a switch by my grandmother, and I would much rather get hit upside the head. And the circumstances behind that as well. The white male violence to enforce patriarchy, ever since the first recorded account of patriarchy, which was way before white people existed historically, violence was used to enforce the dominance on first against the women to destroy the matriarchal system. So it's something that just comes with patriarchy is going to be violence. And everywhere you go around the world, where there's a patriarchal system, doesn't matter if white people are there or not. I like the breakdown he gave on the neoliberalism, which is globalization, which is another name for it, and how black men, the effects it has on black men, and how we're perceived worldwide, which is why anywhere we go, we have the same perceptions through this system. And the antithesis of the neoliberal system that's in place is nationalism, which is why they're going after Trump every day because he has a nationalist mindset. But the progressive racism within academia, which is the number one goal of the Democratic Party, that's their whole platform. That's what they come out of, that progressive academia. And they come right into our neighborhood and we keep falling for it. And the intersectionality, I saw it as a movement. I have to maybe revisit it. I remember when I studied this, it was a movement, a black feminist movement. And I equate it to being a movement used by the white supremacists to further effeminize or demasculinize black men. Because after this movement, black women got put into certain positions that they wouldn't allow black men to get in, which put them in a more dominant role within the household, further taking away from us being allowed to participate in patriarchy under this system. And I'll mute my line.
Much obliged, Thomas, in New York. Other folks who dialed in, especially if it's anybody that we missed totally and you have a question, comment that you want to make sure that you share, do not lollygag. If you have a hand up, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir. Henry in Chicago.
All right. Page 205, it says black masculinity as healthy or nonviolent is formulated as black men embracing something like the feminine or the not masculine. As I was reading it, I thought about something that Dr. Welsing was talking about. I don't know if it was on your show or somebody else's show when they were asking her about this thing of young black males sagging their pants. And she went on to say, pretty soon that the pants will be down to, you know, the ankles, all the way to the point where the pants will be off of these men and then it will be replaced by a dress. So I thought about that when she explained thing of the sagging pants. And where's this at? On page 215, it says, Dr. Curry has a question here. In other words, where does the impetus to pursue patriarchy come from if the biological and cultural basis of gender are distorted? I always thought about when we use the term male and female, under the system of white supremacy, and in any other context, it's always a political construct, and it's not in terms of biological. I always look at, you know, when you look at masculinity or patriarchy, it is, as Dr. Curry has said in this book, it's a form of white male domination. As with white people, they are always looking to dominate on all levels, not just race, but, you know, also gender as well. But, you know, to make sure that the, you know, white people are always on top,
and in particular white males. So I always look at it as political in a sense. And in conclusion, I probably won't be on the call next week. I just wanted to give a brief conclusion on the book. It's a very good book. If you really, really study it, I don't think that it's going to be a one-time read for this book. And I think you've expressed this before about, you know, the language that he uses in order to help people understand. If he probably would have written it in a way where it's more understandable to, you know, to more people, this book would have a lot more impact on the way we think about race and gender. So I myself believe that it's a very good book if you read it a couple of times. Like I said, this will be my third time reading it and understanding it. But Dr. Curry, if he would, you know, tone down the language, this would be a much more powerful book to more people, and I can actually recommend this book to certain people without them having to ask them to read it like three or four times. Uh-huh. So,
you have joined subconference number 8. To return to your main conference, press #*. You have joined the main conference.
Wow, that was quite, let me make sure. Okay. Yeah, that was really odd. Thank you, Henry in Chicago. I got bumped out. I was snickering about, maybe I shouldn't have snickered. Maybe that's the lesson. I was snickering when he was talking about being able to recommend it to more people if, you know, if the vocabulary level was lowered, perhaps the language was a little more accessible. And I got booted out of the line for the broadcast, but seems that we are back. Wowee. Others who dialed in with a hand up, if you have commentary to share, proceed.
Hello, ma'am, Beard.
Greetings, Irie.
Hello again. Okay, really quick. The vocabulary issue. I understand what was just said. I want to disagree with it somewhat because I understand that some people need things more simplified sometimes, but then at the same time, if this is how this, you know, highly educated man in his field is expressing, you know, these conclusions and this research he has, I think perhaps it is also would be due diligence on the reader to also maybe expect to encounter words and phrases that are unfamiliar and to exercise a little bit of research with a dictionary, thesaurus, whatever is necessary to, you know, understand what he's saying. And we don't, we also don't ask like poets and people that write other types of prose to simplify what they're saying. And I do understand that that's more, you know, imaginative and fiction. But either way, if this is that author, if that's that author's way of expressing what they've concluded or what they are feeling, if they're that type of writer, I don't agree with saying, no, you need to simplify more. I'm sorry, I got a little carried away. And this other point, while I was listening to this section, reminded me of a gentleman. His name is Michael Tsarion, Tsarion. And he is a suspected racist, to me at least. I've listened to some of his lectures in the past. I do believe he focuses on Celtic history and Celtic sciences, like comedic, like around that time or something. But he mentioned a lot in society there being a suppression of the feminine. And what I believe, what I'm coming to conclude from listening to this section, parallel to Mr. Tessarian's conclusion that there's a suppression of the feminine, that yes, indeed, there is a suppression of the feminine, but it's not on the, it's not by black men with black women. It is white men with white women suppressing them. And this suppression of the feminine is, they're attempting to carry it over and give it, give blame to black men as well. So for a woman to say, I can't remember her name, Crenshaw or something like that, or I can't remember, for her to say, well, you're a black man, and yes, you're oppressed, and, you know, X, Y, Z, but because you're a man, that, that lessens it, is, that's totally absurd. It's totally absurd. If anything, history has shown that there's more of a target when the person is a, is black and male in this society. So, yeah, that's what I want to say about that. I definitely see a suppression of the feminine on white patriarchy side, and I don't believe, and even more so because of this book, I don't believe there is black patriarchy. I think there's black victimhood on male and female sides, and probably more so on the male side. And I'll mute my line. Thank you, Gus. Thank you, everybody.
Much obliged, Irie. Other folks who dialed in, if you have questions, comments, line should be open. Proceed. Nabbed everyone? Everybody good? I'll share a few thoughts and double check as we have time before we get ready to wrap up. I, as someone who does regularly pay attention to metaphors, I don't know if that is a reasonable comparison in terms of literature that is to inform, particularly literature that's written to educate about racism, and comparing a request that that be written to make it more accessible as opposed to poetry and music. I think that's totally different. If we're talking about writing, because I mean, that is a regular request. If we're writing particularly books from the academy that are supposed to educate, oh yeah, that happens all the time if they are not serving that purpose to educate. Songs and poetry have a totally different purpose that generally is not to educate students, unless I've been misinformed. Other things that stood out from this section of the text. Let's see. The black, we have arrived at a time in theory in which black males are thought to be privileged, even as they are the overwhelming victims of various systems and bodies in society. We've had very scholars, black scholars, come on this very broadcast and insist, oh yeah, black males are privileged in the system of white supremacy. Even saying that sentence together, it, the absurdity of it. However, racists, they can propagate a theory like that in the system of white supremacy to cause confusion. If you have a problem, one of the best ways of keeping people from solving that problem, keeping them confused about it, they don't really understand what it is that they're trying to solve. And they have done, they, racists, whites, have done an extraordinary job keeping us confused about the nature of racism, black male privilege, just another component of it. It's not racism, it's black male privilege. That's the problem. Continuing. Great line here. He says, while the amelioration of these conditions, racism, is claimed to be a part of anti-racist advocacy, the stigma associated with an ontological view of black masculinity would still hold that achieving this goal, saving their lives, would ultimately allow them to harm other men, women, and children in their communities. In this way, the oppression of black men serves a prophylactic function in the minds of theorists who hold the ontological view of black masculinity, because if black males were free, they would seek only to harm or dominate all others they would engage. I think that is very common, the notion of the feverish, violent black male who will run amok and dominate, abuse, or just run after white women. I think that is very, very common. Whites, non-whites throughout the system of racism, white supremacy, and as it might very well be a part of what is also eroding the effort to replace white supremacy with justice. Continuing. I think it's also really important how Dr. Corey presenting that it's easy in white dominated institutions to present these anti-black view, anti-black male views as theory. This is research. This is, you know, the latest scholarly view on how the world operates, that you can do that easily in these environments. No surprise, institutions of white supremacy. I thought this is one I'm definitely going to ask Dr. Curry. Now, he says black male privilege now becomes a rationale that discourages remedying black male underrepresentation by focusing on black males' undesirability, a trope deployed by liberals as a way to justify discriminating against black men. In fact, cohorts of scholars are identified as marketable by the extent to which they argue black masculinity must be avoided. No footnote. Such a stance identifies not only the labor of this academic class, but also their bodies as distant and unsympathetic to the empirical realities and disciplinary erasure of black men and boys. No footnote. He has lots of footnotes here. I would have liked some footnotes to give a little more insight on this. If this is happening, that you can advance your career as a scholar by the degree to which you distance yourself in theory and or physically from black males specifically. No footnote. I'll ask him about that next time around. Let's see. Let's see. Oh, my goodness. The Bill Cosby moment, the second Bill Cosby moment. He was mentioned explicitly during the first audio segment. Then here he says, talking about McKinnon, who influenced Kimberly Crenshaw, black female's theory of intersectionality. Black men enjoyed the benefit of dissuading white women from claiming sexual harassment in the workplace. Direct quote, some white women confide that they have consciously resisted reporting severe sexual harassment by black men authorities because they feel the response would be supportive for racist reasons. McKinnon argued, although racism is deeply involved in sexual harassment, the element common to these incidents is that the perpetrators are male, the victims female. Man, oh man, oh man, I do not know in what time period, in what era, in one country, white women stalled, paused, hesitated from reporting a black male for suspected sexual misconduct. I guess you could say Bill Cosby, but wow, I don't know what weight that argument would hold now, given where he resides. But wow, is that valid? Anybody that's listening think that that's valid? White women at any time. Anytime, 1918, 1919, 2018, 2015, 1970, 1980, 1995, at any time, do you think white women have said, you know what, that nigga patted me on my behind, made comments about his penis, made overtures that I didn't appreciate in the workplace, but I'm not going to report him. We've got a lot of racism, and I think I'm a white woman. They would just ride with my claim, and he'd probably be castrated or fired at least. I'm going to let that slide. Is that anybody's universe that anybody lives in? At any time, do you think that's feasible?
Gus, may I say something?
Yes, ma'am.
I think that statement folded. Well, that's a metaphor. I'm sorry. It collapsed on itself. For to say that white women didn't report sexual harassment because they were going to believe the claim more. I'm gathering what she's saying is they would believe the claim more because it was a black male, but at the end of the day, because he's male, they're not going to believe. It just falls into a black hole for me. So no, I don't agree with it at all.
Hmm. That seem valid? Anybody here listening in think that, yes, I could see that maybe, not all, but maybe a population of white women, yes, I'm going to let that nigger get away with this one because, you know, my report will be believed and it'll ruin his life or career or what have you. So even though he did, you know, fondle me in the workplace, I'm going to let that ride. Anybody think that that is reasonable from at least some white women in a system of white supremacy?
No, sir. Can I be heard?
Mr. Demery Ford, thank you, retired firefighter.
Yes, in my view, you are accurate on that. I don't see in this day and time and in this society white women giving any breaks. As a matter of fact, I can see them making things up and creating situations to put black males in harm's way. I'd like to comment on one part of the book, Crenshaw on page 208, which he said, Crenshaw maintains that the need to split one's political energies between two sometimes opposing groups is a dimension of intersectionality, disempowerment that men of color and white women seldom confront. You know, that do have a footnote to it, but I didn't get a chance to look at it. But just putting men of color and white women in some type of similar circumstance just doesn't fly with me. I'll mute my line, Gus. Thanks for taking the call.
For sure. Appreciate that, Mr. Demery Ford. I did have a few other notes, but we will get to that next week. We should have time. As I said, next week should be shorter because we don't have a whole lot of text left. I can only say that in the decade that we have been broadcasting, making sure that material about racism, white supremacy is accessible, that is something that I've noted as a major problem. There are many, many books written about racism, white supremacy. Unfortunately, I think many of the people who best understand those books are racists. Making sure that the content is accessible to a population that has been deliberately denied access to education and even libraries for centuries at a time. All of that should be factored in terms of how information is presented. If we want victims of racism to have access to better, more accurate information about racism, white supremacy, I think that is, at least for me, that is a major conclusion, huge observation that I've made in the decade that we have been broadcasting, something that I brought up repeatedly with the ISIS papers, with Yorugu, quite a few other texts that have constructive information, but victims of racism have struggled to access the content. We will be here tomorrow, neutralizing workplace racism, first one of 2019, if that means anything on the plantation. If you have, again, Dr. Curry is available. I sent out his email yesterday. Somebody was asking questions about parenting black children and black misandry and all that, given what we're reading in the text, and gave him Dr. Curry's email. Ask away. Take advantage, because I think listeners have done that, and he did respond to them. So take advantage. If you have a question, write him. I think he will get back to you and, you know, let you know his thoughts or what have you. If it's a question about the book, something you didn't understand, ask away. With that, much obliged to all the folks who participated. Hope it was worthy of your time and energy. Sobriety would be best in 2019, really any time under the system of white supremacy. Let's keep our brain computer functioning optimally so that we can go about solving this problem as soon as possible. In addition to being sober, let's be buckled up each and every time we are in a vehicle, driver or passenger. Jonathan Farrell, 2013, was mentioned in the text, North Carolina. Let's be buckled up each and every time we are in a vehicle. Let's do all that we can to minimize contact with race soldiers, badge or no. That's it. Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with another black person, victim of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of Black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another Black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my condition. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.